So we shouldn't take that personally.
Don't believe we have a quorum yet.
How are you?
Let's, did you read the minutes?
I did, and they're wonderful. I moved approval.
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Scalzi moves the minutes of 113 be approved. All in favor of that, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Okay. Now what's the thing? You say damn what? Okay, we're going to unboxing first, huh? Okay. Here we have the Combative Sports Commission before us. Would you please introduce yourself to the members and start your presentation?
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is R. D. Brown, and I'm the Executive Director for the Nevada Sports Commission. On behalf of the commission, we are pleased to have this opportunity to speak with you today and give you an overview of the Nevada Sports Commission. Before I begin my presentation, I would like to give you a brief overview regarding the commission's formation. In 2006, Governor Pawlenty appointed Scott Ledoux as Executive Director of the Boxing Commission. And unlike boxing, which has been regulated for some time, mixed martial arts, commonly referred to as MMA, was a fast-growing sport that was unregulated in Minnesota, as well as other states. As a result, there were many MMA events and tough man contests taking place in the state. Without rules and regulations, there were many injuries to participants, and many jurisdictions did not want these types of events in their areas and banned these events. Scott Ledoux worked tirelessly to have the sport of MMA regulated in Minnesota, and thanks to Scott's efforts, in 2007, the legislature passed the Minnesota Statute 341, Minnesota Combative Sports Commission, to regulate and oversee MMA in Minnesota. Former Governor Pawlenty appointed 9 members to the commission in December 2007. The Combative Sports Commission is located in Blaine. It's one of the few agencies that's located outside of St. Paul. Most small agencies are located within the confines of St. Paul, but we're located at Blaine Sports Center. The mission of the commission is to protect the health and safety of the combatants and to ensure the fairness of boxing and mixed martial arts or MMA events. The commission membership is appointed by the governor. 4 members with knowledge of boxing, 4 members with knowledge of mixed martial arts, 1 retired judge and the executive director. The operations manager is hired by the executive director. The operations manager is here today. We have 2 events coming up next week, 1 in Brainerd and 1 in Rochester, and we're working to get those events scheduled. The commission monitors activities to ensure that, 1, fighters are not exposed to HIV, hepatitis B, or C viruses. We actually have the fighters go through blood testing twice a year to make sure that they're not exposed to any of these viruses. And we also make sure that fighters and opponents are matched appropriately. We review every bout to make sure, and we look at all of the fighters' records to ensure that there are no mismatch.
I'd like to tell everyone we have a quorum now, so this meeting's officially called.
Okay.
Professional fighters are weighed the night before the bout. The reason we do that is professional fighters have a habit of cutting weight. So they may lose 5, 10, 15 pounds. And if they fight that night, they're very dehydrated. So we make sure that they are hydrated by weighing them the night before, and they have a whole 24 hours in which to hydrate themselves. And also before the fight, fighters undergo a pre-bout physical with the physician. He checks them out to make sure that they're prepared to fight, that nothing has happened to them since their last fight. And physicians are also at cage side to make sure that nothing happens within the cage. Every fighter that comes outside of the cage has to see the doctor prior to going back to the locker room to make sure that they're okay. If they need stitches or whatever, the doctor is there to stitch them up at a later time during the fight or during intermission. And at the same time, the doctor makes sure that there's nothing going on when they go back to the locker room. We also have inspectors that are available within the locker rooms to monitor all of the fighters. Hand wrapping is something that we have to be very concerned with, because there are certain hand wraps you can put water on, it will begin to harden, so it's a cast-like substance once they go into the ring. So we make sure that they only use one roll of gauze, one roll of tape. We watch them wrap their hands. We actually sign off on their hand wraps. We watch them put the gloves on. We sign off on the hand wraps on the gloves. And as they come into the cage, there's always someone there, usually me, to inspect the hand wraps, inspect the gloves, make sure that the inspector's markings are there. And we also check the gloves to make sure that they're uniform gloves and everything is okay and there's no hardness on the gloves or whatever. All fighters must serve a mandatory 7-day rest period after each fight. And we do this because of all of the concussive blows and so forth that happens during a fight. We want to make sure that they're okay. Any fighter who has a TKO, loses by TKO, or loses because the ref stops the fight because he's taken too many strikes, they automatically are given a 30-day suspension. The doctor will look at them following the bout to determine whether or not it's going to be 30 days, 60 days, or longer. Any fighter who suffers a knockout or KO is automatically suspended for 60 days. If fighters receive cuts and they have to get stitches, we will suspend them for 45 to 60 days, depending on the number of stitches and the type of cut that they receive. The doctor also can say whether or not he wants them to be out longer or a shorter period of time, but usually it's about 45 days for the stitches to heal. Prior to Wisconsin and Iowa having a commission that oversees combative sports, many fighters that we would suspend would go to Iowa and would also go to Wisconsin. And we would try to make sure that they wouldn't fight, but we had no control over them. But now that Iowa and Wisconsin has a commission, we can keep track of them in Iowa and Wisconsin. Once a fighter is suspended, it goes in a national database, and no other commission will allow a fighter to fight while they're under suspension. Some of our core functions, we sanction all professional boxing. We only do professional boxing. USBA Boxing does amateur boxing. So we sanction all professional boxing and all amateur and professional MMA bouts in Minnesota. We also license all fighters, all trainers, all announcers, judges, inspectors, referees. Anyone that has anything to do with the fight game is licensed by the commission. We also monitor and train judges and referees and inspectors. These are three important people involved in the fight game. Judges, we have to train them to make sure that they know how to judge properly. Referees, we train them to make sure that they know about all of the fouls and things that can go on in the fight, know when to jump in, when to stop the fight, when to end the fight, and so forth. And the inspectors are trained because they have to be in the locker room and with the fighter at all times, so they have to know what's going on within the locker room. They have to understand hand wraps. They have to stand when they are in outside the ring, when the fighter is in their corner. They have to make sure that everything is going on well within that corner. We also monitor all activities during an event. Although we should only be monitoring activities that deal with the fight game, what's going on inside the cage, we also have to be involved in crowd control. Many fights, the people become very emotional, and they rush the cage. And when people rush the cage, it's very dangerous for everybody involved. So all of the inspectors, all of the people that are involved in monitoring the events, we make sure that everything goes on like it should be, that the judges are judging appropriately, that the referees are doing their job inside the cage and so forth. So it's a lot more than just sitting there and watching a fight. Many times we are not watching a fight. We are watching everybody else and see what everybody else is doing within the fight area. We also handle all grievances that come up. When fighters are suspended or when somebody doesn't like something that happened, they didn't like the judge, a judge's score, they didn't like what happened in the ring, we are the ones, we get that grievance. We hold a grievance meeting once a month, and we deal with all of the grievances that go on. We also hold bi-monthly public meetings. These are meetings where we deal with the commission's business and the public is invited. We invite them to participate. We listen to what they have to say as we are making our deliberations about rules, policies, and so forth. We also issue penalties and suspensions for violations. If it's an unauthorized fight, we can issue a penalty up to 6 months to a year, suspension of a license, and up to $10,000 fine. But we abide by the Association of Boxing Commissioners, ABC rules and regulations, and also we have the unified rules that we follow. These rules were developed in Nevada and New Jersey, and our commission follows along with all of those rules. So we're pretty much uniform with all the other states across the country. I have this design here to show you that when we have everything that the commission does involves both the boxing community and the MMA community. We do not operate in a vacuum. We take very seriously what the community has to say about rules and regulations and how we operate, and we try to incorporate all of that so that it's a very collaborative effort on everything that we do. This will just give you a highlight of all of the events that have happened since 2007. So as you can see, MMA has grown quite a bit. We've gone from a total of 9 events in 2007 to a total of 45 events in 2010. And we are currently slated to do approximately 60 plus events in 2011. Now, many times events will change, we'll reschedule, but we're right on schedule to do about 60 events. Most of those are taken up with MMA events, and some of those are amateur events in terms of MMA. Boxing fluctuates quite a bit. We don't have as much boxing as we did in the past. We probably will do about 4 or 5, maybe 6 boxing events in 2011. We have approximately 1,500 fighters, professional fighters, that we license here in the state of Minnesota. We license more fighters during the year. A lot of fighters come in from other states, and we will license those, but we have approximately 1,500 professional fighters that are located here within the state of Minnesota. We also have about 350 amateur fighters located within the state. We have approximately 500 trainers, seconds, and managers. Many of these trainers and seconds and managers are also fighters, so they hold dual licenses. And we have approximately 11 promoters that deal with MMA and boxing. As we said before, we also license announcers and inspectors, judges, referees, and timekeepers. Currently, we receive approximately an appropriation of $80,000 on an annual basis, but that appropriation will end June 30th, 2011. So we will probably be coming back to this committee to talk about future appropriations. The commission generates approximately $40,000 a year in license fees and approximately $47,000 in event fees. Our projected expenditures for fiscal year 2012 are approximately $189,000. Most of that is in salaries and personnel. Everything that we do is hands-on. We have to be there. We have to have the people there. There are 2 paid staff, and then we have approximately 15 or so part-time inspectors that work with us, and we have the 9 commissioners that also get a per diem for every event that they attend.
But Representative Paymar's got a question.
Yes. I'll wait till he's done with his testimony, and well. I have a question.
I can answer questions at this point.
Are you finished? I don't want to interrupt.
I'm not finished, but I can.
No, I'll wait.
Okay,
please.
Recommendations for financial stability. Changing a professional license fee back to $45 would generate an additional $25,000. It was originally $45 for back in 2009. It was changed to $25 for all license fees. Changing the amateur event fee to $500 would generate an additional $10,000. The amateur event fee is only $150, but we lose approximately $300 to $500 on every amateur event. We do the same thing for an amateur event that we do for a professional event. The difference with an amateur event and a professional event is that the promoter does not have to pay the amateurs, because amateurs cannot receive any money. But the commission does the same activities for every event, and we lose about $300 to $500 on each of those events. Changing the amateur license, which is $10 to $25, would also generate an additional $12,500. Many of the commissions across the country receive a portion of ticket sales to help them generate additional revenue. We do not do that here, but if we received a portion of the ticket sales, about $1.50, most tickets are sold starting at $25 and go to as high as $200 to $300 per event. We would raise an additional $25,000 to $50,000for the commission. That ends my presentation. I want to thank you for the opportunity, and if you have any questions.
Representative Paymore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation. I just, the last slide that you had on the increases in fees, if you increased all those fees, I didn't quite follow. Do you need permission somehow from the legislature to do that, A, and B, if you did increase those fees, would you then be in need of a general fund appropriation?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we would need legislation to do that. It was legislation that changed it from 45 to 25, so legislation would have to be done to do that again. It would not generate enough money for us to go without having any appropriations. We would probably need some, but it may be less than the full $80,000. And the reason is because there's a fluctuation in events and so forth. So we may have more smaller events than larger events. Many of the larger events we have at Target Center and the Armory, we would have maybe 1,000 or 2,000 people at some of those events, and we would generate a lot more money in ticket sales. However, if they don't do the large events and they do them at smaller venues, then we would not generate as much, because we would only have about 300 or 400 people coming to some of those smaller events. So that's why the figure of 25 to 50, based on whether it's a large event or a small event.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. I was on this committee years ago when we discussed this. Personally, I just think, you know, it's a relatively small general fund appropriation, but I think that this is, you know, this is something I hope someone will sponsor a bill that allows you to increase those fees, and that this is that the oversight over boxing and combative sports could be done outside of the government purview and handled through fees rather than having state government get involved with general fund appropriations. I just think in a time of shrinking revenue, this is not something that government should be involved in, and although I know the sport, so to speak, needs to be regulated.
Representative Dill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your presentation. I was wondering, had you estimated what the, I understand it was 45, now it's 25 regarding the boxing. Have you estimated what shrinkage you might have in the number of licensees if you raise the fine? Are most of those folks that are licensed today, are they active? Or do they renew their license and then don't participate just because they want to keep licensed? I'm new to this committee, so I don't understand all of that. But the shrinkage concept, you know, raise the price, less people do it. Is that something that you think might impact your overall budget scheme?
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chair, I believe that we may have some shrinkage, but not much. Most of these fighters, they would have to pay a fee if they went to fight in Iowa or Wisconsin, and many of those fees are roughly the same. Some fees are much higher in other states, and many of these people do renew. It's $25 for a amateur, and it would be $45 for a pro, and many people stay amateur for 2 or 3 years and then turn pro. So I don't think we would have any, it would be minimal shrinkage.
Representative Dill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, I'm just a follow-up. If you have a license in Minnesota, you have reciprocity in other states to fight?
Mr. Chair, no. You do not have. If you fight in another state, you have to be licensed in that state.
Okay.
We have fighters that come in from Wisconsin or Iowa, and they have to be licensed here, and their license would be good for a year. We license them from January 1st through December 31st.
Well, like I said, I haven't served on the committee, Mr. Chair, so I'm trying to get my arms around this.
You're probably helping everybody else out, too. Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This isn't on the financial issue. It's on the, you mentioned that there's a certain number of days after a TKO or KO. I've seen some recent studies that show that fighters that used to be called, they could take a punch or something, they get hit a lot and not have a TKO or knockout, but that they have a lot of either brain or neural injuries that later in life affect them. Is there any work on how to look at that so that we can start protecting people a little more that are in that situation, or is that just too far out or too far into the future or something? Or
Mr. Chair, no, that is not. We've been looking at that. As a matter of fact, ABC has been looking at it. There's a meeting that's scheduled in August for the ABC conference, and they're talking about head injury. Many of the physicians that we have at K-Side are trauma physicians, so we do look at that. The physicians are looking at all of the head strikes that are happening during a fight to see how hard they are and so forth. So even though a fighter comes out, if he's been taking a lot of head strikes, even though he may win, we may set him out for 30 days or 60 days because he took a lot of punishment. So it's a mandatory 7 days whether you took hits or not. And if you take strikes to the head, we can give you 30 days or 60 days even if it wasn't a technical knockout or a knockout. So we are looking at that. According to some of the studies, it's a certain period of time before your brain will begin to heal. In 7 days, it will start to heal itself. And if you've taken more injury within a 30-day period, your brain will start to heal itself. And so they're looking at that. And so we're waiting for what's going to happen at the conference in terms of whether or not they're going to issue some new rules and regulations. And we may, at that point, then go ahead and extend the 30 days to maybe 45 days or 60 days, depending on the findings.
Representative Leidinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Boxing and fighting and wrestling have been going on for centuries. And now there's kind of this, there's the new way of fighting. Is that what the MMA is? It's the new, where they put them in the cages and they use the fists as well as the kicking. Is that MMA? Is that what that means? That's one of my questions.
Yes, Mr. Chair. MMA is that mixed martial arts where you can box, you can kick, and you can wrestle, you can grapple, and so forth. And it is in a cage. Sometimes it's held in a ring.
Can I continue? How's the popularity of that? That's what's increasing, if I'm not mistaken. And it says, I mean, it shows by the number of events. And I would like you to speak to, if we do increase these, the various fees, I would think that with the popularity of that MMA, that you'd be pretty much very close to being self-sufficient with this increased popularity that I understand is going on out there. Is that true?
Mr. Chair, that is true. MMA is very popular. It's increasing, all of the fights are increasing daily. It's surpassing boxing. Boxing still has a higher payout than MMA, but MMA is it's a faster growing sport. The problem is the promoters. We're talking about promotions on a local level here. Mm-hmm. So if we continue to increase it to a certain point, we would begin to lose promoters. They would not be able to make money. So we're trying to increase it to a point where everybody can make money, but we can survive as well. And we're trying to find out where that point is. But raising the fee to $45 would not be a detriment to the fighters or the promoters. The promoter fee is only $400 per year.
set of promoters, their expenses are what they pay to fighters. And so I don't think it would have any detrimental impact on the popularity of the sport. What we're trying to do is to bring the UFC, the Ultimate Fighting Championships, back here. We had them here back in 2008, and they rotate. And so I've been talking to them to see if we can bring them back. If we get them back once a year, that's an additional $100,000 or so that we could bring in, but they don't necessarily come every year.
One more really point of information. I think the United States Army backed off on boxing and is now doing MMA. Do you know if that's true?
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if that's true. I know that we do, MMA does a lot of shows over there. UFC sponsors a lot of shows at some of the bases for the troops.
And lastly, just for point of information, I know all the academies, all the guys that go through the academies, Army, Navy, must pass boxing. And if they don't, they get kicked out. So these sports are alive and well. I'm all for them. And I commend your work. Thank you.
Representative Clark.
Well, Representative Leidiger, especially following your comments, maybe I'll be the only voice, but I feel kind of sick to my stomach thinking of people earning money by having other people try to basically severely injure another human being. And it's my health background. I think of, like, when you have this conference and you talk about, you know, whatever kind of head injuries you are going to be looking at and documenting, I would ask you to look at the long-term cost to the public of taking care of people, providing medical care. Please help us. I know that football is doing this. The people who are coming back from war, the incredible head injuries that they have. To me, these are all connect. They're all of a part. And so I guess, Representative Leidiger, I just have to say I want to be the counter voice to. I don't like public dollars sanctioning physical violence, whose purpose in some cases is actually to provide a brain injury to another human being. You get rewarded for a technical knockout or a regular knockout. And I guess there's no sanctions, there's no penalty for those people who deliver those, right? I mean, they win, they're the victor. Isn't that correct? The people who actually knock out the other person.
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chair, you are correct that the person who knocks out the other person wins the fight. And I would agree with you in terms of whether there's the long-term effects and so forth. Our role is to make it as safe as possible. Without regulation, then these would go underground. There would be no regulations. There would be no safeguards. In Iowa, they just started their commission because a 17-year-old boy was severely injured because there were no rules or regulations. So what we're trying to do is we know it's going to happen. We want to regulate it. We want to make it as safe as possible. We do pre-bout physicals. We do after-bout physicals and so forth. We try to keep them out so if there are any injuries, they can go to the hospital. All of that is paid for by the promoter. So I would agree that while many people may think that it may be somewhat barbaric, that people are trying to injure themselves, what we're trying to do is make sure that we have as many safeguards as we possibly can to make sure that the injuries are not as severe as they would have been, and that we regulate it to a point where you don't have unscrupulous people coming in and taking advantage of young people and so forth. So I agree with you, but I believe that we should have some sanctioning. We should have some regulation because MMA and those types of bouts are going to take place regardless of whether the state regulates it or not. It's going to happen. And so it's best that we try to regulate as much as we can and make sure that we sanction it and make it as safe as we possibly can for the people that are participating because they're going to do it.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that that's why you're before us and why we ever passed this law. You know, I understand that that's it. I just want to at least be one voice to say that I do find it barbaric. And I think of the money that we can invest in helping young people find other ways to express themselves, you know, that are more constructive. And I wonder if you track and keep track of the demographics of the people who are entering into these sports. For example, do we know how many of these young people are youth of color or are from low-income families? I mean, do we track any of that? That's one thing I've often wondered, and I'm not sure if the commission is taking any stock of that or wants to.
Mr. Chair, we do not keep stock of that, but just from observation, people of color are not the ones that are going into these events. I mean, it's pretty diverse in terms of the number of the type of people that are coming into MMA, but I would not say that people of color are people that are going into these events. If you go to a fight, you may have one person of color, you may have two people of color at each event. You don't find people of color entering into MMA. You'd find them more in boxing, I would say, than going into MMA.
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as my dad was in the Golden Gloves and actually kept most of his wits up until, except when he was dealing with me, up until his 89th.
Yeah,
I fully understand that. It does affect others in multiple different ways. But I do want to know, and this was something that was discussed, I think, was it 2 years ago or when it was first started, what is the pay-per-view part to your fees? Is there any?
Wow.
Mr. Chair, we do not receive any fees for pay-per-view. There has been talk of every time there's a pay-per-view event going on within the state of Minnesota that the commission receive a percentage of that, but that we have not gone any further with that. To do a pay-per-view, and if we were to receive a percentage of a pay-per-view, since they do at least one pay-per-view per month, we would have 12 pay-per-views, and at least bring in each of those pay-per-views would probably bring in about $100,000 or so, if not more. We would be totally self-sufficient, but that will require the legislature to do that, levy that percentage onto the cable companies and the satellite companies that are now showing those pay-per-views. But that would make us totally self-sufficient.
Well, that at Mr. Chair, $100,000 a month would be. I think that's simple math. At $1.2 million, we could probably fund a couple other things on top of that. So, I think that's
the state.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dill. You had another question?
Yeah, I'm listening to the discussion, Mr. Chair. It brought a couple of things to my mind I need to know about. Mr. Chairman, do you collaborate, or does a national organization collaborate with others? I'm following up on the representative's comments about the head injuries. Do you collaborate with other people that are doing studies? I mean, you can't pick up a Sports Illustrated today for weeks and weeks on end that doesn't show two football players hitting each other, what is now improper in the NFL. And they're studying. In fact, I was looking at Sports Illustrated, and they actually had pictures of MRIs and CAT scans of the brain and what areas are affected. Do you folks collaborate with them to try and figure out how to make boxing and MMA and other combative sports more healthy?
Brown.
Mr. Chair, we do. The ABC also collaborates with the Association of Ring Physicians. And the Association of Ring Physicians just had a conference a couple of months ago talking about brain injury. And we're going to have a conference again in August, and so we will be collaborating. All of the medical doctors and so forth will be talking about that. I would like to point out that most people look at boxing as a much safer sport. Mm-hmm. However, a boxer can take repeated blows to the head round after round after round for 12 rounds and so forth, whereas in MMA, if you get hit 3, 4, 5, 6 times and don't defend yourself, the referee stops the fight. So you, even though MMA may look more barbaric, it is more healthful in terms of the impact that strikes are going to have on your brain and so forth, because you receive less strikes. Many times people will see a person on the ground and somebody pounding away, hitting them from side to side. Well, the fighter has his hands up, so those blows are not hitting the fighter directly. But the referee will stop in because you're not intelligently defending yourself. The ref will step in and stop it. So many of the fights, MMA fights, only last a round. Very seldom do they go 2 rounds or 3 rounds. And championship fights are only 5 rounds. So your MMA fights are much shorter in duration,
the punishment that one would receive if we look at it in that vein is much less than one would receive in a boxing match. And but to answer your question, we are looking at that. We are collaborating with the Association of Ring Physicians, and hopefully there will be something coming out about that. The commission itself, we're looking at that. That's why we are working very closely to make sure that anybody that suffers any injury or anybody that takes any strikes to the head, we make sure that the doctor looks at them. And many times we will have them out and tell them that they cannot come back into the ring until they get an EEG or a neurologist checks them out to make sure that they're okay to come back in and fight. And if they're not, then we won't let them come back in until they're cleared to get back into the ring.
Since we have Minnesota Housing Finance next, we have time for one more question. Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you can't answer this quickly, maybe you can get me the information later. Knowing that there's commissions in Iowa, North Dakota, and Wisconsin, can you tell me if they receive state funding from their states? And also, the other piece I want to know is, how do their licensing fees compare to Minnesota's?
Brown. Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, most of the licensing fees are in line with what we're asking for. And many of the commissions across the country, they are part of the state. They may be part of another department or whatever, and so they receive their monies through that department. We are one of the few that sit outside of other agencies and are sort of separate by ourselves. But most of them receive some state funds.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question to the chair.
Okay.
Is it within the purview of this committee and in purview of the legislature to place taxes or viewing fees on this type of event?
I think if the commission would seek that approval, we could approve it or not approve it. And I'm sure we shouldn't give notice to the people that have pay-per-view come to the committee meeting. Okay, good question. With that, thank you very much for coming and testifying, and we'll look forward to having a bill from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members.
Ms. Orr, welcome to our committee. We have been looking forward to your testimony for a couple weeks now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Tanya Orr with the Housing Finance Agency, and with me is Jeanette Blankenship. You have us today because we only have an acting commissioner at this point, but when the commissioner is appointed, we hope you will invite him or her back to talk with you some more about housing. We're going to provide a brief overview of the Housing Finance Agency. We are sometimes known as the state's mission-driven housing financial institution. So at its core, the Housing Finance Agency is a bank that provides financing for affordable housing. Today we're going to talk about our strategic priorities, our program financing and delivery mechanisms, with a very high-level overview of our programs, and then we'll provide a little information about how housing impacts other aspects of Minnesotans' lives. Jeanette is going to start. We're going to split this up.
All right. Good afternoon. I'm Jeanette Blankenship from Minnesota Housing. You can follow along this packet you should have received if you'd like. In short, Minnesota Housing finances and advances affordable housing opportunities for low and moderate income Minnesotans to enhance quality of life and foster strong communities. Our vision is that all Minnesotans live in quality, affordable homes that positively impact individuals, families, and communities. We focus on four strategic priorities: preservation, new housing opportunities, preventing and ending homelessness, and mitigating the foreclosure impact through prevention and remediation. We'll review these activities related to the strategic priorities as we review the agency's programs. Minnesota Housing is unique in that the management and control of the agency is vested solely in the members of the board by statute. The board is comprised of six members, six citizens appointed by the governor on staggered terms, or not coterminous, and the state auditor. The commissioner is appointed by the governor and charged with administrative control. Minnesota Housing creates a new budget every 2 years called the Affordable Housing Plan. This is the pie chart you've got. Nearly half of the revenue is raised in the private market through revenue bonds. The agency, which has a favorable AA plus rating, issues primarily tax-exempt bonds and provides loans on terms and conditions not available in the private sector. We rely on the private sector infrastructure to deliver and service the loans. Banks get an origination fee and sell the loan to Minnesota Housing, which is a secondary mortgage market, essentially. I should note the agency only uses 30-year fixed mortgages, and our foreclosure rate is at 1%, which is 50% below the current benchmark for comparable loans, according to the Minnesota Bankers Association data. What makes us so effective in responding to the housing needs of Minnesotans are the state appropriations, which are our most flexible funds and allow the agency to meet the mission of serving the most vulnerable, leveraging other funds, and providing the ability to respond to housing emergencies. Now, the agency's operating budget is not funded through state appropriations. Again, not funded through state appropriations. However, we do provide an operating cost report to the legislature every year. Historically, our operating costs are between about 3 to 4% of the amount of assistance that the agency provides. In the last fiscal year, the agency's operating costs were $24.4 million with 210 FTE employees, and it's funded through the small spread that we earn on bonds between the loan rate and the borrow rate. Many of our investments also come with long-term commitment to management. We manage a portfolio of more than 17,000 mortgages and have first mortgages on about 320 affordable multifamily properties. So it's in our best interest, as well as the community's, to ensure properties are managed and maintained well so they can provide quality, affordable housing for the long term and be an asset to the communities that they serve. Now, program delivery. We're primarily a financier, not an originator or an owner or a developer. We work with a diverse network of delivery partners across the state to address the varying housing needs for each region. You'll see a map of the regional distribution of assistance. This map shows that our regional distribution of assistance between shared assisted households, which is the map, and the share of funds for the region, and the share of eligible households, which is shown in the table, are really quite close in most cases, in that the number of people we're serving, the amount we're giving, and the number of eligible people is all fairly close, within a few percentage points. We don't have targets for the amount dedicated to each region, but we respond to the housing needs that are raised by the regions, whether it's the need for more workforce housing or rehabilitation to allow seniors to stay in their homes or to finance supportive housing for a growing homeless population. Now I'm going to move on to the program overview, and we've got a lot to say and not much time, so if you have questions, feel free to pop in or hold them till the end. As mentioned previously, we have four strategic priorities. State appropriations complement the agency's other resources to maximize the impact and leverage other funds. We'll go through these programs in each of these priority areas. In federal fiscal year 2010, Minnesota Housing assisted more than 72,000 households in the amount of $711 million, including $406 million for nearly 46,000 rental units or tenant households, and $305 million for more than 26,000 homebuyers or homeowners, addressing these four strategic priorities. Now remember, 77% of this is funded through revenue bonds and federal pass-through through the Section 8 program. The agency has two primary methods for preserving existing affordable housing. Amortizing or deferred loans are provided to homeowners or landlords through programs such as the Home Rental Rehab Program, the Fix-Up Fund, and the state-appropriated rental rehab loan program. The other approach is through financial incentives to preserve important affordable housing stock in the Section 8 portfolio, which is achieved through the Affordable Rental Investment Fund for Preservation, also known as HARIF. HARIF leverages and retains $5.70 of federal assistance for every $1 of state assistance we provide. Preservation is really important because of this leverage it can achieve. And we know that the per unit cost of development costs for preservation and rehab work is well below the cost of new construction. In addition, our lowest income households are served through programs that preserve existing affordable housing and rental units. And typically, preservation activities are funded through revolving loan programs. Now, for financing new affordable housing, I just want to take a moment to note that Minnesota housing programs provide assistance to households with a wide range of incomes. However, program guidelines generally set income limits for eligibility. So more than 78% of renter households reporting to Minnesota Housing in 2010, not including Section 8, which are actually lower, had incomes of less than $20,000. Among home buyers and homeowners, more than 54% had incomes less than $40,000. Now, the state-appropriated Economic Development and Housing Challenge Program funds a number of activities, including deferred loans for both renters and homeowners. The Challenge Program provides crucial tax credit gap financing to optimize the availability of federal housing tax credits. Minnesota Housing leverages $7.30 for every $1 that we invest in tax credit developments in gap financing. It's quite a return. One recent tax credit development is Gateway Plaza in Chanhassen. Gateway Place has 48 units of affordable housing in an area with limited housing options for low and moderate income families. One family, the Villasanas, were among the first residents to move in and were delighted to settle into a three-bedroom unit where each of their boys have their own room. One of the greatest advantages of their move is that Mr. Villasanas works in the community and has dramatically reduced his commute from Richfield now that he lives in the same community where he works. This location provides the family a quieter and more convenient place to call home. Now, as mentioned in the finance section earlier, bond finance first mortgages for first-time homebuyers are typically at an interest rate below what is available in the private market. The loans are originated by private financial institutions and mortgage lenders. Minnesota Housing is a secondary market for these loans. The median household income for a new home buyer is a little over $40,000, and Minnesota Housing is the number one housing finance agency in the country at serving lower income home buyers, with one of the highest homeownership rates in the country, but also one of the largest gaps between white homeowners and homeowners from communities of color. We encourage our private originators to do outreach to communities of color. We were well beyond our expectations in 2010, with 33% of our mortgages made to families from communities of color. Our state-appropriated Homeownership Assistance Fund is a revolving loan fund that provides deferred loans for down payment assistance with some pre-purchase counseling, which is required, and down payment assistance. Many people can become very successful homeowners. So I'm now going to turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Tanya Orr to address the next two strategic priorities and the impact that housing has on communities.
Representative Mulry has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know that you used to have a whole slug of loans on housing that had no security on it. Do you have any kind of security on those now or not?
Representative Mulry, Mr. Chair, except for very small loans to homeowners for rehab, we have a security interest in all our loans.
Mr. Chair, I guess I don't know what that means. Is there a lot of them like that, or how small is that? Because there used to be a lot of, as I recall, this is a couple decades ago, $5,000 to $10,000 loans that had no security on them, and if there was merely something filed on that, you'd eventually get it back.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulry, we rarely make a loan that's as small as $5,000 for a home improvement, but there may occasionally be a case where a homeowner is looking for a really small amount of money, and in some cases then we do not have a mortgage on that property, but that is an exception.
Mr. Chairman, what would be the normal cutoff or something on where you'd ask for some type of a security interest?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulry, I'll have to get back to you about the exact figure. I don't know what it is today.
Representative Stenzel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious to Representative Mulry's question. What would be a typical percentage of like that security? Are you looking for a certain dollar amount or a certain 2, 5, 10% down? Or help me understand that, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in a case of an existing homeowner that's looking to borrow money from the agency for rehabilitation of their home, in most cases they probably have a first mortgage. We would take a second for the entire amount of the loan that we're making. We do have some, we cannot and do not loan more than 110% of the value of the home, so the first mortgage with combined with our loan can't be more than 110% of the value of the home. So there's some restrictions there. In the case of a first mortgage for a first-time home buyer, the down payment that's required is determined by the originator of the loan. It is typically these days, and it varies depending upon the economic conditions, it's typically between 3 and 5% of the mortgage amount.
Continue.
Another one of the agency's strategic priorities is to prevent and end homelessness. Our efforts to prevent and end homelessness range from providing rental assistance to households who are in a shelter and trying to either move them out of a shelter quickly or provide some assistance to people who are at risk of moving into a shelter and to avoid that, to rental assistance for people who have a household member who suffers from a mental illness, to providing assistance with the capital costs of permanent housing. Our prevention assistance has been particularly effective in both moving people out of shelters very quickly and in avoiding people using shelters. We have recently learned about a World War II veteran who was living in a mobile home and had an RV. And was using about $10 a day of his VA benefits to pay for propane. He got referred to the Family Homeless Prevention Program in Hennepin County. They helped him with his veterans benefits, and he is now receiving veterans benefits for 100% disability. His income has increased to the point where he now can live in permanent housing that does not need a rental subsidy. So it's not your typical we're providing rent, but you know it's a very creative. How do we prevent people from becoming homeless?
And Mulry's got a question.
Uh-huh. Sure. You said 3 to 5% down. How does that compare? I know that's way under the regular rate, but how does that compare to HUD or other federal programs?
Ms. Lohr.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulry, this would be an FHA. At this point, between 80% and 90% of the loans that the agency is buying right now are FHA insured, and so it's what FHA requires. We as Ms. Blankenship mentioned, the underwriting standards are provided by the originating bank. We do not impose them.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up. I know that you used to have. This is probably before you were there. It goes back into when I was representing the agency and stuff. There used to be programs with no down payment, and you actually paid all the closing costs and everything, and I know those ended up not doing very well. Do you still have that kind of program, or I mean, that's an understatement when I say not doing well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulry, we always require the home buyer to make a contribution to the down payment or closing costs. There are I'm not aware of any products right now that are no down payment products. I want to reiterate the fact that Ms. Blankenship referred to earlier. Our foreclosure rate for the Minnesota housing portfolio of loans is well below the state foreclosure rate, well below. So we have, for a number of reasons, including home buyer counseling, a below market interest rate, some assistance with down payment assistance, the homeowners that get assistance from the Housing Finance Agency are quite successful in their homeownership.
Representative Swiddens?
Mr. Chair, going back, you know, with when you're going on your second, to take up the second mortgage, do you do a home inspection? Do you do appraisal on site or anything like that? Or how does that process work as far as a natural?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the home improvement loans are just, in some ways, they're just like a first mortgage in that you go to your, you go to Wells Fargo, you go to U.S. Bank, you apply for a loan. They say, you know, you meet the income qualifications, you're eligible for a housing finance agency loan, so you maybe get a better, so you get a better rate or a longer term or a fixed rate so that you wouldn't. So it's the process that the bank uses for their.
Gotcha.
And I this is an important we think this is an important thing that is sort of a I think not something that you commonly see with state agencies, but we really do rely on completely on a network of private lenders to deliver the state assistance. So they are making decisions like they would with any other mortgage product or home improvement loan product. It's those are things that we don't impose on them. We just provide the financing. We have experienced an increase in homelessness in recent years, due primarily to the changing economic climate. In the last Wilder survey, 40% of the people who were surveyed and are homeless reported that they had lost a job or had reduced earnings and hours and of employment, and that is the reason for their homelessness. So we are hoping that as the economy turns around, we will once again see a decrease in this number of people that are homeless. We have made some special efforts to provide not only assistance for people who are experiencing long-term homelessness, but also people who have recently come into the shelters to provide some short-term rental assistance, particularly for families with children, to get them out of the shelter quickly and stabilized in their housing. Another strategic priority for the agency is to mitigate the impact of foreclosures. And this mitigation of the impact is sort of is two-pronged. It's both for the individual homeowners, but it's also for the community at large. Number of you, Representative Mulry in particular, know that having a large number of foreclosures in your community has a devastating impact on the community itself, as well as not to mention the homeowners who have lost their housing. So we have taken so our efforts are directed at both the community and the individual homeowner. Minnesota actually, we're the highest, we have the highest home ownership rate. We're rank about 16th in terms of the percentage of all mortgages that are in foreclosure among, nationwide. We have seen a slight decline in foreclosures in 2009, but that was due primarily to a temporary moratorium that banks had imposed on foreclosures. That foreclosure rate has gone back up, and the 2010 rate is expected to be about, or number of share of sales is expected to be about what it was in 2008. We don't see an end to the foreclosure problem soon. It has, while it originally concentrated in some center city neighborhoods primarily, it now has moved out into the first ring suburbs. It's not so much about subprime lending now. It's more about ARMs and unemployment. unemployment is one of the biggest reasons that we're seeing foreclosures. So this is not this is a problem that we're going to continue to address, but it's not one that we fear it will not go away soon. So I mentioned one of the things that we do to mitigate the impact of foreclosures is to try and prevent foreclosures. So we have a state and a federally funded foreclosure prevention program. It's called the Homeownership Education and Counseling Assistance. HECAT is its acronym. And this program has actually, we've seen about half of the people who receive foreclosure prevention counseling are able to avoid foreclosure. Now, that doesn't always mean that they stay in their house, but they may be able to avoid a foreclosure and do a short sale or some other thing that would protect their credit rating, which would make it easier for them to get into rental housing and eventually back into homeownership. We have also spent a fair amount of money, about $68 million, on remediation efforts in neighborhoods that have been impacted by foreclosure. And that is primarily money that's used to acquire and rehab homes, and then those homes are sold to eligible home buyers. We also have provided a fair amount of down payment assistance and closing cost assistance for families who are willing to buy foreclosed homes or buy homes in foreclosure impact areas, all of which help stabilize the neighborhoods and return them to a successful community. One of the things that everyone is talking about now is jobs. It's important to remember that two things about housing and jobs. One is that unfortunately, there have been 60% of the job losses since 2000. There's been a 60% reduction in jobs since 2000 in the construction trades, and that's primarily residential construction. But the other thing is, both the rehab and the new construction of housing helps create jobs. So we have found, we did a study a couple of years ago, and we found that for every $1 million of investment by the Housing Finance Agency, about 15 jobs are created. And those are primarily in the construction trades. So these investments not only help house people, but they help get some of our construction workers back to work.
Mallory has a question.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I often hear those jobs quoted in many different ways, and there's so many different ways. Like, they'll say, you know, this project is going to be 3,000 jobs, and it's actually one job for 3 years for each person. Other way, but then it can go the opposite way, where they'll say there's a certain number of jobs created and it's just the actual construction workers. It doesn't include the what the economists call the secondary and tertiary effects, which when you get out to about an eighth or tenth degree is pretty questionable, but your second and third probably are. So is this, what does this really mean, that is it which of those different ways of looking at it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, this is both the direct and indirect jobs. So it is, as a result of a construction worker having a job, it's also you may have to add an additional cashier at the grocery store.
Well, thank you.
But they are all full-time equivalent jobs. There are multiple studies that show that having stable housing helps families stabilize. In both their school performance, their and attachment to the workforce. I mentioned earlier that we had provided some temporary rental assistance for families to move, who had recently ended up in the shelters, to move out of the shelters and become stabilized. What we've found is that with a small amount of rental assistance, families who had moved around were staying in their home for more than a year, which really helps the school systems enormously when they don't have to have kids running, moving in and out of their classrooms all the time, but have a stable classroom. It makes a huge difference in kids' educational achievement. We also, there are also a number of studies that demonstrate that families that who are on welfare, who have stable house, stable affordable housing, have a greater attachment to the workforce and have greater earnings. So once again, not only are you putting a roof over people's heads, but you're also helping them move up the economic ladder. So I want to leave you with just a couple of key points. One is I can't stress enough the amount of leveraging that the agencies, that state's investment in housing makes. The tax credit program is one of the more dramatic. For every dollar that we spend, we get about $7.30 of private money that's invested in housing. Again, the work that we do is done almost exclusively in partnership with private developers, nonprofit developers, financial institutions, and nonprofit organizations, and local units of government. There's very little that the agency does on its own. We always work in partnership with someone else to deliver our assistance. We're in a tough economic time. And that means that there are lots of stresses for people in housing. But if they have stable housing, they're more likely to have good school outcomes and be attached to the workforce. Finally, we'll talk about this a lot more when we make a budget presentation, but even though state appropriations are a relatively small part of the overall budget for the Housing Finance Agency, they are very critical to our achieving what we do, and it makes a difference between us being sort of just a regular old bank and a bank that can help people who, without our assistance, would not have stable, affordable housing. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Seeing none, thank you very much for an enlightening presentation.
Thank you.
Yep, Representative Clark.
Back on the foreclosure issues. I mean, yeah, I'm aware that I think our foreclosure is as high as they've ever been, and they're probably going to get worse, and it's such a devastating impact not only on families but also on communities. In the home help entry cost program there, mm-hmm. Can you tell me what the demographics are of those folks who are being helped to buy up the foreclosed property? Are these some I'm especially interested if any of them are the folks who have had to leave that neighborhood, if they might be able to come back, and what the average entry cost assistance is today from the agency, and anything else you can tell me about what we know about the foreclosure situation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I'd be happy to get you, I don't have the demographics of the home help assistance. Well, maybe we have a little bit, but I'm going to have to get back to you. I don't have that data in my head right now, but I would be happy to do that.
Any other questions? Hang on, thank you.
Thank you.
Meeting is adjourned.